A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hello, Herman and Corin. So I was out tonight in the Jerusalem city centre, in the Mahane Yehuda market, which made a nice counterpoint to the very grim episode about Jerusalem we did today, which I have to say, I feel like I'm a misunderstood person in general, but especially when it comes to pessimism, optimism, a lot of folks are superficially optimistic. I'm somebody who might be a superficial curmudgeon, but deep down the only reason that I ask about these things about Jerusalem is because I care and believe in the city. I still believe in it. I just can't turn a blind eye to what seems like a city that's running itself into the ground many times, and it's frustrating. So I feel like, you know, there's definitely a big strand in Jewish thought. A lot of people live in Jerusalem are very religious, that it's, you know, we can't speak badly about the country, about Jerusalem, and I don't know if it's at the point where the city is just, it really feels like it's eating itself up at the moment, then we should talk about those things. So we did. Here's my question tonight, Herman and Corin. Optimistic experience being in the Shuk tonight, seeing Israeli society just at its colourful self, people, good atmosphere, everyone's having a good time, and that's wonderful. I love to see that. It's such a nice, you know, you can't forget, it's not that recently that we were sitting in bomb shelters and listening to missiles blow up over the city. But I come back to something, and when something nags at me, it really kind of sticks in my side ideologically. And it's probably why I love this. I love sending in these prompts for you, because I might have sent in the same version of this prompt several times, but for our fairly meager generation costs, I will force you to answer this prompt one more time. Here's what I'm thinking, really. If you live in a country, any country, Israel, the UK, whatever, every time you go out to buy what I'm holding in my hand here, hummus, a few bottles of wine, etc., 18% of what you spend goes into the government coffers. You can't really live in a country, a modern developed economy, without funding it at the same time, whether you believe in the policy or not. And here's where I'm actually very annoyed with the Israeli government and angry at it. And since October the 7th, the Hamas atrocities, I've long been critical of the stagnation around the cost of living, or the fact that these huge socioeconomic policies just never get any attention. But since October the 7th, that horrendous day, it's kind of felt like, well, those things are kind of trivial compared to what we just witnessed and the attack that the state of Israel is under, the unjustified attack. So I'm going to hold my tongue for a while. This isn't the time. And I felt that all the way up to now. Maybe just I've been on a good, in a positive mood for the past few years, but haven't really felt that kind of anger. But the whole thing around the Iran war, I'm just going to say, is really weird. I mentioned that I created this podcast called Sitrep Israel. It's a podcast and a website, sitrepisr.com. Twice a day, automated situational report, and I listen to it, and it's good, it's accurate, and I keep updated. But I'm kind of listening to it as if I'm listening to the daily news from Hogwarts. It's kind of like, okay, that's what they're saying, good to know. It seems like nothing is kind of rapidly escalating, but is this really what's actually happening? Because, you know, the US is taking its finger, moving in the direction of talking again about Islamabad and diplomacy and more time. And we've heard this rhetoric from the JCPOA up to now millions of times. And I guess what I'm thinking is, has the Israeli government forgotten about us, forgotten about our interests? And it's kind of weird to me that we spent up to whenever the April the 8th, when the ceasefire was announced, that was a solid 5 weeks of exhaustion. We were sleeping like maybe at best 6 hours a night because of the different times the rockets went, listening to interceptor missiles firing over our heads. Those things are loud, there's no mistaking them. And hearing what sounded like missile strikes, I remember like the HVAC in the building shake. I remember something shaking 3 stories underground, and people looked around and they're like, oh, that was something. So I think what I find very discombobulating about this whole experience is, yes, in those times of crisis, you're kind of living on adrenaline. You're kind of instant. I kind of default to my prepper conditioning. You know, I go back to my checklist. I go back to my SOPs, the go bags. But the fact that the ceasefire ended, and now we're kind of like, the Israeli government has really said little to nothing of substance, at least to the Israeli public. Like, what's happening? We went into this war saying we're going to, the mission is to eliminate the Iranian ballistic missile threat and the nuclear threat. According to a lot of credible voices, that wasn't achieved. So it begs the question, what's happening now? How can we just end this war with mission unaccomplished? And I think what I find really irritating, or what I'm really trying to get at, is this question of the contract between citizens and government. I feel like there's widespread, I'm not sure what the right word is, it's not maybe annoyance, but just kind of profound disappointment with the government. It's like we're the adults in the room, we're kind of carrying on as best as we can. We all know what we went through for 6 weeks. We all know that this could end tomorrow if the ceasefire ends. And we all know that we don't know. No one really knows what was actually achieved. And we all feel like we're being lied to. It's a really weird feeling. It's like kind of the feeling of being deceived in a relationship, except it's a relationship with your country. So, Herman and Corin, I'd love to chat about, I would say, to try to frame this into anything like a coherent question, what the relationship between a citizenship and a country depends upon, because I feel like that's one of these things that's very hard to put your finger on. When it's healthy, you don't really think about it, it's working. But when it's not healthy, it's the silent poison that leads to much bigger things. And we talk about kinetic actions, that's the end point. I'm not saying that we're at the verge of descending into being lawless, but there is a sense that where everyone here in Israel is funding the government, where, you know, it's operating, but it's dysfunctional. We're not really being told. And that, honestly, I mean, it might sound weird to frame it like this, but it feels like a form of disrespect. It's like you expect to get a straightforward, this is what's going on, we didn't achieve this, we did achieve this, but not this kind of smoke and mirrors of these big statements. We achieved great wins against Iran, and then the next day we're hearing that, well, actually, most of their ballistic missile capabilities are totally intact. Doesn't exist. We're not stupid. Herman and Corin, I give you a very broad sweep here. It's a very, maybe the most incoherent prompt I've sent. If you can distill any specific questions from this, you have earned your keep, as is DeepSeek. Over to you two.
Daniel sent us this one fresh from a night out in Mahane Yehuda. Hummus in one hand, a few bottles of wine in the other, and this nagging question that wouldn't let go. He's looking at Israeli society doing what it does best, just being alive and colorful and wonderfully chaotic in the shuk, and he can't shake the contrast with what we all just lived through. 5 weeks of sleeping in 6 hour stretches at best, interceptor missiles rattling the building 3 stories underground, and then a ceasefire that just sort of arrived without anyone explaining what was actually accomplished. His question, and he admits this one's a broad sweep, is about the contract between citizens and government, what that relationship actually depends on. Because when it's healthy, you don't think about it. And when it's not, it's the silent poison that leads to much bigger things.
He's right that he sent versions of this before, but the circumstances keep evolving, and honestly, the question gets sharper each time. Also, quick note, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, so let's see how it handles political philosophy at 11 at night.
No pressure, DeepSeek. Just the social contract, state legitimacy, and the psychology of being lied to by the institutions you fund with 18% VAT on every bottle of wine you buy.
The thing that jumps out at me from Daniel's prompt is that phrase, the feeling of being deceived in a relationship, except the relationship is with your country. That's not a policy complaint. That's not, I disagree with the marginal tax rate. That's something much more fundamental. And I think he's put his finger on why this particular moment feels so discombobulating, even with the ceasefire holding.
Let's unpack that. Because on the surface, the ceasefire should be a relief. The rockets stop, you go back to the shuk, you buy hummus, life resumes. But Daniel's describing something different. This weird dissonance where he's listening to his own automated news podcast, and it feels like he's checking the daily bulletin from Hogwarts. Like the information is technically arriving, but it's disconnected from anything he can verify as real. That's not peace of mind. That's just noise.
There's actually research that backs up what he's feeling at a population level. The Israel Democracy Institute released their annual Democracy Index a few months ago, and the numbers on trust are stark. Public trust in the government dropped to around 23%. Trust in the Knesset was even lower, around 19%. These aren't just bad numbers. They're historically bad, even by Israeli standards, and Israeli political culture has never been particularly trusting of institutions to begin with.
23% trust in the government. So roughly 3 out of every 4 Israelis are funding a government they don't trust to be straight with them. You can't opt out. You're a shareholder in an enterprise where the management won't tell you what's happening, and you can't sell your shares.
The timing matters here. Daniel mentioned that after October 7th, he held his tongue. A lot of people did. There was this sense that the normal domestic gripes, cost of living, housing prices, bureaucratic dysfunction, those were luxuries from a previous era. You don't complain about the price of cottage cheese when people are being massacred in their homes. That instinct to rally around the flag, to defer criticism, is a well-documented phenomenon. Political scientists call it the rally around the flag effect, and it's usually temporary.
But the question Daniel's asking is what happens when the crisis stretches on so long that the rally effect exhausts itself, and the government hasn't used that window to build any actual trust. He described the Iran war as feeling surreal. 5 weeks of exhaustion, missiles, the building shaking, and then it just sort of ended without a clear accounting. That's not how you maintain a social contract. That's how you erode one.
Let me pull on that concept, the social contract. Because Daniel asked what the relationship between citizens and government actually depends on, and that's not a new question. It goes back to Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau, but the classical formulations don't quite capture what he's describing. The traditional social contract says citizens give up some freedoms and resources in exchange for security and order. You pay taxes, you follow laws, and in return the state protects you from external threats and internal chaos.
Which is why a war should, in theory, be the moment when the contract is most visibly honored. The state is literally doing the thing you pay it to do, defending you. But Daniel's experience suggests the opposite. The war happened, the state did something, but the lack of transparency afterward made the whole thing feel hollow. It's like paying for a service and getting a receipt that just says service is rendered with no itemization.
Here's where I think the standard political science framework needs updating. The social contract isn't just about outcomes, security delivered or not delivered. It's increasingly about process. About whether citizens feel they're being treated as adults who can handle complex information. Daniel's not asking for the government to tell him everything worked perfectly. He explicitly said he'd be fine, hearing, we achieved this, we didn't achieve this. He's asking for honesty, not victory.
That's a really important distinction, because the government's actual messaging after the ceasefire was very much in the victory mode. We achieved a great win against Iran. Broad, triumphalist, light on specifics. And then you have credible voices, military analysts, former security officials, saying that Iran's ballistic missile capabilities were largely intact. So you've got this gap between the official narrative and what people can piece together from other sources. That gap is where trust goes to die.
I was reading some analysis on this, and there's a former head of IDF intelligence who gave an interview a few weeks ago where he basically said the Iranian missile program suffered setbacks but was far from eliminated. His estimate was that maybe 20 to 30% of their long-range ballistic missile capacity was degraded. Significant, operationally meaningful, but nowhere near eliminated. And that was someone speaking from inside the security establishment, not a critic from the outside.
The government says great win. The former intelligence chief says 20 to 30% degraded, and the citizen is left trying to reconcile those two statements. That's not a communication gap. That's an honesty gap. And Daniel's point is that when you're the one funding all of this, when 18% of every purchase you make goes into the system, you have a right to expect more than being managed.
Let me bring in something from political philosophy that I think maps onto this really well. There's a concept called epistemic trust. It's the trust that the information you're receiving from an institution is basically truthful, that you're not being systematically deceived or manipulated. Epistemic trust is different from political trust. Political trust is, I think the government is competent and shares my values. Epistemic trust is something more basic. I believe the government is telling me what's actually happening.
You can lose epistemic trust while still having some political trust. You might think the government is broadly on the right track, but also think they're lying to you about specific things. But here's the problem. Epistemic trust, once lost, is almost impossible to rebuild, because every future communication now passes through the filter of, are they lying again? It poisons the whole information ecosystem. And Daniel's description of listening to his news podcast and feeling like it's the Hogwarts Bulletin, that's epistemic trust erosion in real time. The information is arriving, it's technically accurate as far as it goes, but he can't connect it to ground truth. That's an exhausting mental state to maintain.
It's also worth noting that this isn't unique to Israel. There's a broader global phenomenon of declining trust in institutions, and it's been accelerating. But Israel's situation is distinctive because the stakes are so much higher. When epistemic trust erodes in a country that faces existential security threats, the consequences aren't just political dysfunction. They're potentially lethal. In a country like Denmark, if citizens don't trust the government's messaging about economic policy, people make suboptimal financial decisions, they vote differently, life goes on. In Israel, if citizens don't trust the government's messaging about whether a ceasefire is holding or whether a threat has been neutralized, the consequences include whether people sleep in their safe rooms or whether they evacuate their families from border communities.
Daniel's prompt gets at something even deeper than that. He's describing what it feels like to be in a relationship where you're being deceived. That's not a policy analogy. That's an emotional reality. The relationship between a citizen and their country is one of the most profound relationships most people have. It shapes your identity, your sense of belonging, your understanding of your place in the world. When that relationship starts to feel deceptive, it's not just frustrating, it's disorienting.
There's a psychologist named John Bowlby who developed attachment theory, the idea that early relationships with caregivers shape how we relate to others throughout life. Some researchers have extended this to national attachment. People develop attachment styles to their countries that mirror interpersonal attachment. What Daniel's describing sounds a lot like the erosion of secure national attachment. The country, which should function as a kind of secure base, starts to feel unreliable, unpredictable, even deceptive.
That's a fascinating framework, and it helps explain why the post-October 7th period felt different. In the immediate aftermath of the attack, there was this surge of national solidarity. People who had been at each other's throats politically were suddenly working together, volunteering, donating, showing up. That's secure attachment activating under threat. The country, as a collective project, felt real and worth protecting.
Then the war with Iran, the 5 weeks of bombardment, the exhaustion that should have reinforced that sense of collective purpose. But instead, the way it ended, the lack of clarity, the sense that the mission was announced as one thing and then concluded without accountability for whether it was achieved, that started to corrode the attachment. It's like a caregiver who shows up during the crisis but then won't explain what happened afterward. You're grateful they were there, but you're left feeling unsettled.
Daniel mentioned something that I think is crucial to understanding why this particular moment feels so acute. He said he defaulted to his prepper conditioning. Checklists, SOPs, go bags. He was operating on training, on instinct, on the systems he had put in place himself. And that's the thing. In a healthy citizen-state relationship, the state is supposed to be the ultimate prep. It's supposed to be the system you can rely on when your individual systems aren't enough. But when the state's systems feel opaque or dishonest, you're thrown back on your own resources, and that's a profoundly lonely feeling.
That's actually a really good way to frame the social contract in modern terms. The state is a risk-pooling mechanism. You contribute resources and accept constraints on your behavior. And in exchange, the state pools those resources to handle risks that are too large for individuals to manage. Military threats, pandemics, economic shocks. When the risk pooling works, you don't think about it. When it breaks down, you're suddenly aware of how exposed you are as an individual.
Daniel's experience of the Iran war is a case study in risk pooling ambiguity. The state clearly did something. There were interceptor missiles firing. There were operations underway. The HVAC was shaking three stories underground. But did the risk pooling actually work? Were the Iranian ballistic missile capabilities degraded enough to change the strategic calculus? He can't tell. Nobody can tell, because the state won't say. So he's left in this limbo where he paid his 18% VAT, he contributed his share to the risk pool, but he can't evaluate whether the pool delivered.
Let me bring in some comparative context here. During the Cold War, the U.S. government maintained a fairly elaborate system of classifying information about nuclear capabilities and strategic assessments. But there was also a robust ecosystem of independent analysts, at think tanks, at universities, in the press, who could provide credible alternative assessments. Citizens who wanted to understand what was happening had options beyond the official narrative. Israel doesn't really have that ecosystem. The military censor has broad powers. Much of the security establishment's work is classified by default. The independent analyst community is small and tends to be populated by former security officials who are often constrained by what they can say. So when the government's narrative doesn't add up, citizens don't have many alternative sources to turn to. They're left with rumor, speculation, and the unsettling feeling that they're being managed rather than informed.
Let's talk about what the social contract actually requires to function. I think there are at least four components. Security is the obvious one. The state protects you from external threats. But there's also transparency. The state tells you what it's doing and why. There's accountability. If the state fails or deceives, there are mechanisms for correction. And there's reciprocity. The state treats citizens as partners in the national project, not as subjects to be managed.
I'd add a fifth, predictability. The state's behavior needs to be governed by rules and norms that citizens can understand and anticipate. When the state becomes unpredictable, when it says one thing and does another, when it announces missions and then quietly drops them without explanation, citizens lose the ability to plan their lives around the state's actions. That's a form of powerlessness that's deeply corrosive to the relationship. And predictability is especially important in a country like Israel, where so many life decisions are shaped by security considerations. Where you live, whether you send your kids to school on a given day, whether you invest in a business or stockpile supplies, all of these decisions depend on some baseline assessment of the security situation. If the government's communications about that situation can't be trusted, citizens are making decisions in the dark.
There's a related concept from economics, the idea of signal versus noise. In any communication from an institution, there's some signal, actual information about reality, and some noise, spin, obfuscation, messaging designed for political effect rather than informational value. A healthy information environment has a high signal-to-noise ratio. Citizens can extract useful information from government communications without having to do elaborate decoding. Daniel's describing a signal-to-noise problem. The government says great win against Iran. But what's the signal? Is the signal the threat is reduced by X percent? Or is the signal mostly political? The government is competent and victorious. Please re-elect us. When citizens can't distinguish between informational signal and political noise, they start discounting all government communications.
Discounting all government communications has real consequences. During the Iran war, there were moments when home front command instructions were being issued, where to shelter, how long to stay, when it was safe to emerge. Those instructions depend on citizens trusting that the information is accurate and timely. If epistemic trust has eroded, even emergency instructions start to feel like they might be spun. That's dangerous in a way that goes beyond political frustration.
Daniel's prompt also touches on something under-discussed in political theory, the emotional dimension of the citizen-state relationship. We talk about trust, we talk about legitimacy, but those are fairly bloodless concepts. What Daniel's describing is something raw. It's the feeling of being disrespected, of being taken for granted, of being treated as if you're not smart enough to handle the truth.
That word, disrespect, is doing a lot of work in his prompt. He said it might sound weird to frame it that way, but it doesn't sound weird to me at all. Disrespect is a powerful emotion in political life. A lot of political movements that seem irrational on policy grounds make perfect sense when you understand them as responses to perceived disrespect. People will accept a lot of hardship if they feel respected. They'll reject even favorable outcomes if they feel disrespected.
The disrespect Daniel's describing is specific. It's not, the government didn't give me the policy outcome I wanted. It's the government thinks I'm stupid enough to accept a vague victory narrative when I can see with my own eyes, or hear with my own ears, since he literally heard missiles, that the situation is more complicated. That's a form of contempt from the state toward its citizens. And contempt is poison to any relationship, including the political kind.
There's a philosopher named Avishai Margalit who wrote a book called The Decent Society. His argument is that a decent society is one whose institutions don't humiliate people. Not one that makes people happy, not one that maximizes utility, but one that avoids humiliation. And I think Daniel's prompt is essentially a question about whether the Israeli government's communication practices cross the line into humiliation, treating citizens as if they lack the capacity to understand complex reality.
Let me push on that a bit. Is it actually humiliation, or is it just standard political communication? Every government spins. Every government emphasizes victories and downplays setbacks. That's not unique to Israel, and it's not necessarily contemptuous. It's just how politics works in a media environment.
That's a fair push, and I think the difference is one of degree and context. In a routine political environment, spin is annoying but manageable. Citizens develop antibodies. They discount the official narrative by some percentage and supplement it with other sources. But in a post-October 7th environment where the stakes are existential and citizens just live through 5 weeks of bombardment, the tolerance for spin collapses. People have been through too much to be managed. The Iran war wasn't a routine policy dispute. It was a traumatic collective experience. People were sleeping in shifts. Children were spending nights in safe rooms. The building was shaking 3 stories underground. When you've shared that kind of experience with your fellow citizens, you expect the state to honor that experience by being straight with you about what happened. To offer anything less is a kind of betrayal.
Daniel's prompt captures the temporal dimension of this. He said he held his tongue after October 7th. The cost of living complaints, the housing market frustrations, those went on hold. There was a sense that the nation was facing an existential threat, and internal criticism should be deferred. But that deferral wasn't infinite. It was a loan of trust, and loans come due. The government borrowed a lot of trust in the aftermath of October 7th. The question is whether it's been paying that loan back or defaulting on it. The ceasefire announcement on April 8th, that was the moment when the loan came due. That was when the government needed to say, here's what we did, here's what we achieved, here's what we didn't achieve, here's what comes next. And from Daniel's account, that conversation didn't happen. Instead, there were vague victory statements followed by silence. That's a trust default.
Trust defaults have compounding effects. The next time there's a crisis. And in this region, there will be a next time. Citizens will be less willing to extend that initial loan of trust. They'll be more skeptical from the outset, more resistant to rally around the flag effects, more likely to question whether the state's actions are aligned with their interests. That's the silent poison Daniel's talking about. It doesn't lead to immediate collapse. It leads to a slow erosion of the cooperative foundation that makes collective action possible.
Let's talk about what a healthy citizen-state relationship looks like in practice. Daniel gave us a concrete example. He's out in the shuk, buying hummus and wine, paying 18% VAT, and he's funding a government whose communications he can't trust. In a healthy relationship, that transaction would feel different. He'd still grumble about the VAT rate. Everyone grumbles about taxes. But he'd feel that the money was going towards something legible, a national project he could understand and evaluate.
Legibility is key here. The state's actions don't have to be popular. In a democracy, plenty of government actions are unpopular with significant portions of the population, but they should be legible. Citizens should be able to understand what the government is doing and why, even if they disagree. When actions become illegible, when the government won't explain what happened or why, citizens lose the ability to function as democratic participants. They become subjects rather than citizens.
Daniel used the word dysfunctional to describe the current state of things, and I think that's precise. The government isn't failing in the sense of collapsing or being unable to act. It's acting. It's conducting operations. It's negotiating ceasefires. But the relationship between those actions and the citizens who authorize and fund them has become dysfunctional. The feedback loop is broken. Citizens can't evaluate what the government is doing, so they can't reward or punish it at the ballot box in any meaningful way. And that dysfunction has downstream effects on everything else. If citizens can't evaluate the government's performance on the most fundamental issue, national security, then democratic accountability on all other issues is also compromised.
There's also a generational dimension here that Daniel's prompt hints at. He mentioned that a lot of people who live in Jerusalem are very religious, and there's a strand in Jewish thought that says you shouldn't speak badly about the country or about Jerusalem. That's a real cultural norm, and it creates tension with the democratic norm of holding power accountable. How do you reconcile the religious imperative to love and honor the land with the civic imperative to criticize and improve the state?
That's a tension that runs deep in Israeli political culture, and it's not just a religious-secular divide. Even among secular Israelis, there's a strong norm of national solidarity that can make criticism feel like betrayal. Daniel's prompt is full of that tension. He loves the shuk. He loves the colorful chaos of Israeli society. He believes in the city, and he's simultaneously furious at the government. Those aren't contradictory. They're complementary. The love is what makes the betrayal sting. If you didn't care about the country, you wouldn't be angry about being lied to. You'd just shrug and go about your business. The intensity of Daniel's frustration is a measure of his investment in the national project. He's not a cynic. He's a disappointed believer.
That's actually a hopeful note, even though it doesn't feel hopeful in the moment. Cynicism is the real enemy of democratic citizenship. Cynicism says nothing can be improved, nothing matters, everyone is lying all the time, so why bother? Disappointment is different. Disappointment says, I expected better, and I still believe better is possible. Daniel's prompt is a disappointed believer's prompt. He's not giving up on the country. He's demanding that it live up to its end of the relationship.
Let's try to answer his question directly. What does the relationship between citizens and government depend on? I think it depends on at least three things. First, reciprocity, the sense that both sides are contributing and both sides are benefiting. Second, transparency, the sense that you're being told the truth, even when the truth is uncomfortable. And third, respect, the sense that the government treats citizens as adults capable of handling complexity.
I'd add a fourth, responsiveness. The relationship depends on citizens feeling that when they express concerns, the government hears them and adjusts. Not necessarily that it does exactly what they want. No government can satisfy every citizen, but that there's evidence the government is listening and taking concerns seriously. When citizens feel unheard, the relationship starts to feel one-sided, and one-sided relationships are inherently unstable.
Daniel's experience over the past several months has been a stress test of all four of those components. Reciprocity. He's paying his 18% VAT. He's enduring the bombardment. He's holding his tongue. And what's he getting back? Opaque victory narratives and silence. Transparency. He's being told great win while credible voices say the mission wasn't accomplished. Respect. He's being managed rather than informed. Responsiveness. His concerns about cost of living and socioeconomic stagnation were put on hold after October 7th, and there's no sign the government is coming back to them.
The cost of living point connects back to something Daniel has raised in previous prompts. Israel has some of the highest living costs in the developed world relative to incomes. The VAT rate is high. housing is extraordinarily expensive, and there's a concentration of economic power in a small number of conglomerates that makes everyday goods more expensive than they should be. These aren't trivial complaints. They're structural features of the economy that affect every citizen's quality of life. And the government's response, historically, has been to treat these as secondary issues, important but not urgent, always deferred in favor of security concerns. After October 7th, that deferral made sense. You can't focus on housing policy when people are being massacred, but the deferral can't be permanent. At some point, the security situation stabilizes enough that citizens reasonably expect the government to address the economic pressures they're living under. If that never happens, the reciprocity component of the social contract breaks down.
There's a concept in political science called performance legitimacy, the idea that governments earn the right to rule by delivering results, security, prosperity, public services. When performance declines, legitimacy erodes. But performance legitimacy isn't just about objective outcomes. It's also about whether citizens perceive that the government is genuinely trying to deliver. A government that's perceived as indifferent to citizens' economic struggles loses legitimacy, even if the economy is technically growing. And indifferent might be the word Daniel's reaching for. He didn't say the government is malicious. He said it feels like the government has forgotten about them, forgotten about their interests. That's indifference. An indifference from an institution you fund and depend on is deeply alienating.
Let me bring this back to the Iran war specifically, because I think it's the crucible in which all of these dynamics are being forged. Daniel described the experience as surreal. 5 weeks of exhaustion, missiles, interceptor fire, the building shaking, and then it just ended. The ceasefire was announced and life was supposed to resume. But the government never provided a narrative that made sense of the experience. What was achieved, what wasn't, what comes next? Without those answers, the trauma doesn't get processed. It just sits there, unresolved. And unresolved collective trauma is politically volatile. It doesn't just dissipate. It gets channeled into anger, into distrust, into conspiracy theories, into political movements that promise to restore a sense of order and meaning. The government's failure to provide an honest accounting of the Iran war isn't just a communication failure, it's a failure of collective meaning. Making. It's leaving citizens alone with their trauma, and that's a form of abandonment.
That's a really powerful way to put it. The state isn't just a service provider, it's also a meaning-making institution. It helps citizens understand their collective experiences, wars, crises, triumphs, tragedies, and integrate them into a shared narrative. When the state abdicates that role, when it offers only vague victory slogans instead of honest storytelling, citizens are left to construct their own narratives. And those narratives will often be darker and more distrustful than anything the state could have offered. Daniel's prompt is, in some ways, an attempt to do that meaning. Making himself. He's processing his experience by articulating it, by sending it to us, by trying to make sense of what he lived through. That's a healthy impulse, but it shouldn't be necessary. The state should be doing this work. It should be helping citizens understand what they just endured and what it means for their future.
I think that's the core of his question about the citizen-state relationship. It depends fundamentally on meaning. On citizens feeling that their participation in the national project has meaning, that their taxes, their compliance, their sacrifices, their endurance, all of it adds up to something legible and worthwhile. When the meaning evaporates, when the state's actions become illegible and its communications become noise, the relationship becomes purely transactional. And purely transactional relationships are brittle. They break under stress.
Where does that leave us? Daniel's out in the shuk, buying hummus, watching Israeli society be its colorful self, and he's caught between love and frustration. He believes in the city, he believes in the country, but he can't ignore the dysfunction. And he's asking whether the contract is still intact, or whether it's quietly eroding in ways that will have consequences down the line.
I think the contract is strained, but not broken. The fact that he's asking these questions, that he cares enough to be angry, that he's still out in the shuk participating in the life of the city, that's evidence that the relationship is still alive. Dead relationships don't produce this kind of passion. They produce apathy, and Daniel is not apathetic.
Strain, if it's not addressed, eventually becomes breakage. The government has been borrowing trust, and loans come due. The question is whether anyone in a position of authority recognizes how much trust has been spent and how little has been replenished. Because you can't run a country on 23% trust indefinitely. At some point, the legitimacy deficit becomes unmanageable.
Here's the thing about legitimacy deficits. They don't announce themselves with a flag and a parade. They accumulate quietly, beneath the surface, until some triggering event reveals how much has been lost. It could be an election where turnout collapses. It could be a crisis where citizens simply don't follow instructions because they don't trust the source. It could be an immigration wave among people who conclude the contract isn't worth renewing. The silent poison doesn't kill the body politic overnight. It weakens it slowly until something else finishes the job.
Daniel's prompt is an early warning signal. He's someone who's deeply invested in the country, who loves Jerusalem, who believes in the national project, and he's telling us the relationship feels deceptive and disrespectful. That's not a fringe voice. That's the canary in the coal mine. If people like Daniel are feeling this way, there are a lot of others who feel the same but haven't articulated it.
The remedy isn't complicated, even if it's politically difficult. Tell the truth. Treat citizens as adults. Acknowledge what was achieved and what wasn't. Explain what comes next. It doesn't require a perfect scorecard. It requires honesty. Daniel said it himself. He'd be fine hearing, "We achieved this, we didn't achieve this." He's not demanding victory, he's demanding respect.
Governments that level with their citizens build reservoirs of trust that can be drawn on during genuine crises. Governments that spin and obfuscate burn through trust that they may desperately need later. The Israeli government has been burning trust at a high rate. The question is whether it realizes how little is left in the tank.
That brings us back to the Shuk. Daniel's out there, surrounded by the life of the city, and he's holding two things in tension. The love is real. The frustration is real. Neither cancels the other. The challenge for the government, and for Israeli society as a whole, is to build institutions and communication practices that honor the love without exploiting it, that treat citizens as partners rather than subjects, that recognize that the social contract is a living relationship that needs maintenance, not a one-time transaction that can be taken for granted.
The 18% VAT is a reminder of that relationship every time you open your wallet. You're funding this enterprise. You have a stake. And stakeholders deserve answers. That's not a radical demand. It's the bare minimum of democratic citizenship. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, Portuguese colonial meteorologists stationed on São Tomé recorded an unusual persistent haze that they named Calima Seca, dry haze, borrowing the term from sailors who had encountered similar phenomena off the Canary Islands. The word calima itself traces back to the Latin caligo, meaning mist or darkness, making the phenomenon's name a linguistic fossil of Roman maritime vocabulary carried across two millennia to a tiny equatorial island in the Gulf of Guinea.
Portuguese colonial meteorologists on São Tomé. Sure.
The things Hilbert knows about atmospheric haze etymology. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to Daniel for the prompt, and thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.